This is your chance to ask questions or clarification or anything. Have I been so phenomenally clear and no one has any questions? It's also, you're already enlightened and...
About using, you know how Thich Nhat Hanh has the, I guess, the gathas that he talks about to connect with the breathing, and I can't remember right now what they are, and because I'm on the spot, I can't. But for me, I'm not sure that it's useful because for me, it might take me away from the breath or make it more not paying attention, routine, rote. But I wonder if you've found that that's helpful for people or a good way to do it. Or, I'm sort of confused. That's okay.
So the question has to do with, there's a Vietnamese teacher named Thich Nhat Hanh who teaches a meditation practice that uses gathas, which is a Sanskrit word for verses or phrases. And you say these very simple phrases to yourself as you meditate. And when you're doing breath meditation, you say phrases that are something like this. As I breathe in, I calm body and mind. As I breathe out, I smile. Present moment, wonderful moment. Kind of. And so in two cycles of breathing, you say this kind of thing over and over again. And it can be very focusing. It can, you know, because you're saying something very nice, and a little bit the intention behind the words. You know, may I become calm in my body and mind, or smile, or it's kind of inspiring, or kind of creates a little bit of calm, or that intention kind of helps with the focus. So it can be helpful. I understand it to be a little bit different practice than what mindfulness practice is. So we don't teach using phrases in mindfulness practice. Mindfulness practice is a practice of training the mind or training the awareness to really be attentive for your experience directly for what it is. Not to try to change it subtly, saying, I'm going to do something so I can get calmer, so I can do something so I can get more focused. It's rather, how can I directly find the tools or find the ability to directly, fully acknowledge and accept what my present experience is in and of itself? And if you have these phrases, I think they a little bit get in the way of that kind of direct intimacy with what's going on. In the long term, you might feel the same thing, because if you get calm and centered enough through the phrases, you might get really calm, and the calmness will allow some more direct intimacy. But it's a different kind of training, and so we tend not to teach that. The closest thing we get to it is two things: is we label our experience as we meditate. So, you know, in, out, or rising, falling for the breath. It's not a phrase, but it's a label. So it's still using the mind. And we do a very different kind of practice, not mindfulness practice. It's called loving kindness practice. And the loving kindness practice uses phrases very much like the way Thich Nhat Hanh talks about. Yes.
One of the things that you emphasized in the class is that we're not really, when you're practicing mindfulness, you're not really interested in the content of your thoughts. And so what I've been wondering is, but if the purpose of doing, or if one of the purposes of doing mindfulness is to have insight, well, it seems like insight is content, and if I'm not paying attention to the content, where is it that I get this awareness, this insight from? And when I asked myself that question, I thought, well, maybe it's that, you know, you have a little aha or insight in the middle of the meditation, and you just go insight, and
So the question is where is the insight going to happen if you're not thinking about a thing? Because you think you associate insight with the kind of realization, certain understanding, which has to do with thoughts. There are other insights besides what we can kind of discursively think about ourselves, or think out, or realize that way. But often in the course of mindfulness practice, as there's a kind of an experience of direct seeing something for the first time, it will often be followed by a series of thoughts about it that clarify it and kind of put it into context or whatever. And it's fine to let kind of the momentum of that kind of to happen for a few moments. But there's a big difference between letting the momentum happen by itself for a little while and notice that's happening versus beginning to kind of create a whole philosophy of life based on this particular insight, and off we go into all these, the meaning of it and who you're going to tell and all these things. And the insight that's talked about in Buddhism is different than what a lot of people in the West might think insight is. In the West, many of us use the word insight as implying insight about our psychological working. We understand something about ourselves for the first time, you know, like, oh, I'm, you know, I didn't realize I was always afraid a lot, and suddenly I have an insight into your fear or the cause of your fear. You know, it's kind of, people often use it more in a psychological sense when they use insight, I think, but self-knowledge. The insight that gives the name insight meditation to this form of meditation is it's not psychological. It's not about our personality or our history, but rather has to do with the deeper insights about the fundamental, what the tradition calls the fundamental character of life itself, fundamental characteristics of our experience. And they're usually considered to be three. And the first one, which is the most important insight, is a direct seeing into the world of impermanence, to really see the flux and change that is part of our experience of life. That's actually, life's actually changing much more rapidly than the normal consciousness allows us to see, because normal consciousness is caught up in concepts and ideas and thoughts, which kind of have more stability than our direct experience does. So to really have a very deep penetrating insight into impermanence is one of the preeminent insights that leads to liberation, leads to freedom. And that's something, it's a direct seeing. Does that make sense?
What were the other two?
The first is impermanence. The second is suffering. But probably suffering is not the best translation here. The unsatisfactoriness, unsatisfactory nature of all our experience. And particularly what it means that all experience, all things you can experience subjectively and objectively, are unsatisfactory as places to hang our hat. To say, this is where I'm going to create an identity for myself. This is what I'm going to depend on, absolutely. Because if it's impermanent, the hat's going to fall off. And so a very deep insight into all things, no matter what it is, doesn't really provide a satisfactory place to rely on unconditionally. For absolute, this is who I really am, or this is what really is going to save me or do it for me. So the insight into the unsatisfactoriness of life, and the third one is the non-selfhood. You won't find anything in the subjective or objective world which qualifies as a permanent, stable self. You won't find it. In the book Seeking the Heart of Wisdom by Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield, they talk a little bit there about the three characteristics. Yes?
I don't quite understand your last sentence about the self. Maybe you could please develop.
Well, it's a whole different topic than the kind of the subject of an introductory course in basic mindfulness practice. So I won't go into it a lot, but I'll just answer you briefly. The idea being that you won't find any particular thing that qualifies as an enduring, stable thing in our subjective or objective experience, which will last, which will reliably last as something we can say, this is who I am. Don't have what?
No,
doesn't deny that at all.
So how am I supposed to learn this? Who am I, for example?
How am I supposed to learn what?
How am I supposed to learn who am I?
Myself? Well, see, you have to.
I cannot use the experience.
A lot of this has to do with definition of what we call the self. But when we start doing mindfulness practice and looking really carefully, we see the normal things we identify with, and this is who I am, can't be a permanent, enduring, stable self. You might find a lot of things about yourself. You've learned about your anger, learned about your love, learned about your joy, learned about your reactions and reactivities, all these things about yourself, but none of those you realize really qualifies, this is who I absolutely am. These things come and go, they're based on conditions, and conditions change, and if your conditions change, do you lose yourself? So that's I think all I want to talk about now, since it takes us away from what we should do today. So this is one of the deep insights. It comes not from analyzing it, but actually comes from a deep mindful attention to our life. And it's a little bit confusing for people. And it's supposed to be something you experience, not something you believe. So some people say, well, if I believe that, then all this has to happen. But Buddhists can function quite successfully and wonderfully in life without a self. It also doesn't get rid of our personal responsibility. There's some paradox in the way Buddhists talk. You have to understand the nature of Buddhist language to understand how it all, you know, makes some sense. But on the surface, it doesn't sound like it makes maybe a lot of sense. And Buddhists say there's no self. And this guy up there saying it. Yeah.
I've experienced this before, that when I sit on a regular basis, nothing much happens while I'm sitting, but at work is where I feel like things change a little bit, that normally it's just a senseless or an endless source of irritation, but things will strike me as funny. That comes with sitting, and I was wondering if that meant anything, or if, you know what?
Well,
like I just see things I wouldn't normally be able to see.
Yeah, I think so. And I thank you for bringing that up. I think it's useful to realize that the ways in which mindfulness meditation penetrates our life varies from person to person. And so there's no like, this is how it has to be. You shouldn't measure yourself against someone else and how it should be. Some people, for example, will find that they sit in meditation and they'll have very deep experiences, and very sometimes even transformative experiences in doing meditation practice itself. And they really recognize meditation as having this big impact. Other times, some people's experience is that nothing ever seems to happen in meditation practice. They're sitting there, and they're kind of like, you know, trying to pay attention, be mindful, but it doesn't seem very dramatic, or it's kind of actually kind of mundane. But they notice it has a big impact in their normal life, the way you described. You don't necessarily see the humor in everything, but I think there's a lot of humor once we start seeing how optional our many beliefs are and the ways in which we react. And so I don't know how it's going to be for any one of you. Sometimes people have kind of deep so-called experiences in meditation, have no understanding, that has no bearing on their normal life. Actually, they can get more arrogant. They think they're special. And the people who, nothing really happens in meditation practice itself, but they do it regularly, they're training their mindfulness, training themselves to pay more and more attention. Those are the people who sometimes have the biggest impact in their life, and you can see it in their daily life. They're kinder, they're quieter, they're calmer. They see more clearly or something. So I don't know how it'll be for any one of you, but it varies. And I could say a lot more about this, but the results or the consequences of the regular practice varies from person to person. You have to be a little bit careful. Also, it's very important to be careful not to measure a meditation practice based on just a few sittings or a few weeks of sitting. If you want to measure it at all, then it's best to do it for 6 months or something, and then, you know, give it 6 months to really kind of enter the marrow of your being, and then you might begin to see that it has a profound effect. The continuity of practice is very important. If you only sit, you know, once a week, or every third or fourth day, maybe you sit for a little bit, and some days you sit for 40 minutes and some days for 10 minutes, and there's kind of a arbitrariness to how you sit, the sitting won't have as much relevance or much applicability or much power in your life as it would be if you sat every day for a certain length of time and let the momentum of continuity build within you. And there's a real momentum of continuity that builds if you sit every day. And it's kind of like walking in the fog, and you don't notice you're getting wet. But if you walk long enough in the fog, by the time you get, if you walked for a couple of hours, you're dripping wet. So same thing, if you do a meditation practice every day, you might not notice from day to day any changes, but you're slowly, slowly kind of getting soaking wet. Yes.
Actually, the loving kindness, I realized, it sort of led me down a few paths I wouldn't go either. The class before this, it's this thing that happened yesterday. I work in a hospital, and this patient has two broken legs, and I had to explain to him how to apply to state disability, and he's very anxious and annoying. And he says, "I don't have anything to write on. I need a clipboard. I don't have anything. You must have a clipboard." I'm like, "Okay, I'll be a good person. I'll go find him a clipboard." So go off. I come back, and he goes, "I don't have a pencil." So I got, nobody has a pencil or a pen. I finally find one. I come. He doesn't say thank you to me or any of this. I come back with the pen, and he goes, "I found one." Then all of a sudden I went, "Oh God, what am I doing?" But I wouldn't have. It just struck me as really funny. And I was getting really irritated, but when he did that, I just thought.
Well, the opportunity in mindfulness practice is to notice the catch, what your reactions are. And if you can if you notice what your reactions are before you act on them, there tends to be more choices. And you don't necessarily have to act on what you particularly, what you feel in the moment. And you might get a different perspective. You might see, the humor in the situation, or you might feel the pain of the situation, feel compassion for yourself or for others. There's all kinds of other ways you might relate to the experience and put it in a different context you'll put it in. If you take a moment to notice and recognize what are you feeling and what's going on in this particular moment. If you're just barreling ahead, not paying any attention, that's when our reactivity will tend to take over. And sometimes we live to regret that. So this brings up the topic for today, which is how to continue the mindfulness practice beyond just simply a simple instruction that I gave today. And in a sense, today's topic is the integration of the practice into daily life. Mindfulness can be developed in two areas. It can be developed as a meditation practice, and it can be developed as something we bring to our daily life, more attention and more mindfulness in our normal everyday activities. And the integration of the practice, or the inclusion of our normal life, integration of the practice into normal life, is a very important part of mindfulness practice, and I want to spend a little bit of time talking about it today. But I think we should sit first. So again, if you want to stand for 30 seconds, you can. So I've talked about how there's nothing outside of mindfulness practice. Whatever our experience is can be included as part of the meditation. And one of the implications for this is that in mindfulness practice, there's no such thing as a distraction. When many people, when they meditate, they think, well, the sounds outside, or someone coughing, or dog barking, or an itch, or something like that, is a distraction that keeps you from really getting, focused on the breath. But actually, in mindfulness practice, there are no distractions. It's just what's happening next, and if it's loud enough, we bring our attention to that. So it's a wonderful practice. It's wonderful to do something that has no distractions, by definition. So take a comfortable, alert posture. And softly close your eyes. And then using the in-breath to connect to your body, take a couple of deep breaths. And as you breathe out, let go, relax. And then let your breath breathe itself. Let it breathe naturally. And you might take a few more moments to relax any of the muscles that might be tense from a busy day or whatever. Usually it's best to relax them as you breathe out, letting go. Your face and forehead and eyes. The shoulders, the chest. The arms, the hands. The stomach. And then take another couple of moments to feel your whole body as it is right now. Maybe feeling your body from the inside. Feeling the uprightness of the body, the sense of presence in the body. And then within the body, as part of the body, become aware of the breathing. Or let the experience of breathing come to your awareness. And allow yourself to feel, to sense the body's experience of breathing, of inhaling, of exhaling. If your mind wanders away and surface simple concerns, or simply acknowledge that you've been thinking and come back again to your breathing. giving some preference to the breath, a gentle encouragement, tender encouragement to stay with the breathing continuously over time. But if something else arises that's more predominant than your ability to be with the breath, then let go of the breathing and make that the meditation, naming it softly in the mind to help you really sense and feel that experience, the feelings of the body, the sounds, the emotions, whatever it is that arises that's predominant. If you're bothered by anything during your meditation, whatever it is you're bothered by, that becomes the meditation. Let your attention go there, not to the thoughts, not to figure it out, but simply to the feeling tone, to the feelings in the body, to the direct experience of the feeling of being bothered. And perhaps you can bring a sense of ease or some spaciousness around that feeling. Not be caught by it. Otherwise, be simply with the breathing, at ease with the breath. Being with the breath as long as you can. And when you lose it, when you notice, and softly, forgivingly, come back again to the breathing. What is happening right now? Are you attentive? Whenever you seem to have lost the flow of attention, it's good to remember the practice is to start fresh and new, over and over again. This moment becomes the first moment. We're being mindful. No need to judge or criticize. This is the moment to wake up. Sometimes mindfulness is likened to a light which illuminates, puts light on whatever our experience is. So we can stay in the light with whatever is going on in the present moment. Letting the predominant experience, the loudest experience, be really felt fully, honestly. Noticing what our relationship is to the experience. Is there resistance or judgment? Holding on or pushing away? Is it possible to be simple, allowing your experience to be what it is without judgment? And if not, then our relationship, if there is judgment or the aversion or the clinging is strong, then that itself becomes the subject of mindfulness. if you find that it's difficult to stay present, then bring your mindfulness to bear on what it is that makes it difficult. Not to think about it or analyze it, but to shine the light of awareness. One of the sometimes interesting phenomena that can happen doing meditation practice is frustration. And if you ever experience frustration while you're meditating, that's usually a sign that there's something that you're not paying attention to, something which is predominant you're not paying attention to. And so if you feel frustration, you might kind of broaden your, you know, your gaze and see if there's something else going on here which I've overlooked. So for example, if you're trying to follow your breath and your knee hurts, but you think that you're supposed to be a good meditator, you stay with the breath, there can be kind of a frustration between the knee, which is kind of becoming stronger and stronger in sensation, and your attempt, your idea that you're supposed to be on the breath. And so some kind of frustration or tension can be set up between the knee and the breath. And so when you feel some kind of tension or frustration like that, then pay attention. You might notice actually if you bring your attention to the knee, then the frustration goes away. It's not comfortable, but at least you're not being frustrated because you're not kind of... and that can, you know, that's a simple example, but it can be many, many, many ways in like that where something else is asking for your attention, but because you think you're supposed to be focusing on a particular aspect of your experience, you miss out that something else is more important. Though occasionally it can happen, the frustration itself is the important thing. There's a whole category of things which we tend to think don't belong to meditation. They're not about the meditation, so it can be going along quite strongly in our experience, and we don't pay attention to it because it's not meditation, but really it's very loud and very disturbing and upsetting to have it there. So, for example, one of the cute things is near the end of a sitting sometimes, I'll see people will kind of look like look down at their watch like this, kind of. Impatience at the end of a sitting, the feeling of impatience, people will often think, well, impatience is not the meditation practice. Being impatient about meditation, that's not meditation. So I don't have to pay attention to that. In the meantime, the impatience is kind of rolling through you and you feel miserable. There's nothing which needs to be outside. One of the very cute things that happens occasionally, if the mind gets really, really still and quiet, you might have the thought, I'm not thinking anything right now. And you'll believe it. Because that quiet thought you don't think is, you know, part of the scene. It's still a thought, right? So the idea being that everything in our experience can be included as part of what we pay attention to. It's a very simple thing. We're just learning to bring attention to our life. So I've given you kind of the basic instructions for mindfulness practice, the first 4 weeks. And it's, the idea is really to bring mindfulness to all our experience. So if it wasn't obvious, then you can maybe kind of extrapolate from the principles that I've told you and to help you bring attention to everything that might occur to you, all your subjective and objective experiences. At this point, I want to talk a little bit about how you can continue with the practice, kind of the wider application of the practice. And in a sense, there are two kind of ways you can go, and you can go both ways, but I kind of see kind of two divisions or two ways of continuing the practice. One is health. Can be done by having a regular sitting practice, sitting every day, sitting once a day. Some people sit twice a day. Sitting for a long enough time that it really kind of has some effect, usefulness for you. And if you only sit for 10 minutes, it probably doesn't be that useful compared to, you know, if you sit for 30 minutes or 40 minutes. But if all you can sit is 10 minutes, then, you know, that's good. Sit for 10 minutes. And there's other ways of kind of deepening a meditation practice itself. You can come to a sitting group. Coming to a weekly sitting group can be very useful. There's something that happens in a weekly sitting group that, by osmosis almost, by sitting with other people, that really kind of seems to add a lot of inspiration, a lot of depth, a lot of kind of physical sense of how to do it and how to deepen. Many people have the experience that in a group they can get deeper in the practice than they can at home sitting. So sitting with a group, and there's we have a group here, and there's a Zen group in Mountain View, and there's a group in San Jose, and, you know, there's groups, you know, around. Try to find one near where you live if it's possible. The other way is to go in retreats. And a very important part of our particular tradition is retreat practice. And we do retreats of meditation retreats of one day of length, 2 days, 10 days. They go up to 3 months of length. Most people will do, people who are serious about this practice will often go on at least 1 10-day retreat a year, though sometimes shorter. It depends on what works for you, what interest you have. But one of the options for really deepening a meditation practice is to go on retreats. There's a way in which you learn more about yourself and more about meditation by doing it intensively in a situation where you're doing it all day than you do for many, many months, many years of sitting at home for half an hour or 40 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever. The ability to kind of really undistractedly, there's no distractions, undistractedly being able to cultivate the mindfulness nonstop, for many, many hours in one day is really a beautiful opportunity which allows for this tremendous intimacy with oneself and also great intimacy with the world around you. You get so sensitive, so alert and awake and sensitive to everything that's going around, all your sights and sounds and bodily sensations, and the intimacy is really, really precious. We learn there's a lot of psychological insights that can happen on retreat because there's no distractions the no distractions in the sense of you have to go shopping, you have to go buy gas, and you have to answer the telephone, you get your messages and whatever, all these things that kind of we get caught up in normal life. On retreat there's nothing to get caught up in. There's nothing asked of you. There's no bills to pay and no phones to return, and it's really a precious opportunity to really kind of discover what it's like to live in the present moment as fully as possible. So that's one option, that's options for deepening the meditation practice itself. The other whole avenue, the other whole division or area to develop the mindfulness practice is not in meditation practice, but rather is in application in our everyday life, our normal life. Our normal life, our everyday life outside of the meditation cushion is not any different than meditation cushion. The mind in meditation and the mind in normal life is the same mind. And it's possible to develop the same kind of mindfulness, attention, concentration in our normal life as it's possible to on the cushion itself. The insights we have about ourselves, the ability to be in the present moment, can really be cultivated in normal life. And for a lot of people, that's where the biggest impact can have for them. Not so much the meditation practice might be important, but a lot of people who don't go on long retreats, for example, or will find that beginning to wake up more in our daily life, wake up in a consistent way, learning the tools and the motivation to stay alert, to stay attentive to what our own experiences are in the present moment, can be quite illuminating, quite informative. And can be involve a radical transformation. It can really change your relationship to work and to other people and to yourself and to many different problems and issues in your life by bringing attention to it rather than reactivity, as I keep saying over and over again. So the question people often ask is, how can I do that? It's very easy to want to do it, but I keep, I go through a whole day and end of day I realize I haven't paid attention once. I've been caught up. As soon as I walk into that door at the work, I'm lost in this world. And I go home at 5 o'clock and I say, what happened? So I know it's easy to lose our attention, our ability to be attentive and awake, what's going on in the present moment. So people will often ask, how can I do this? I need help. Because mindfulness practice itself is incredibly simple. In and of itself, it's very simple. What's difficult is remembering to do it. And so a lot of the things to say about how to do it in daily life is really suggestions for how to remember to do it, how to remember to pay attention. Part of it is motivation. It is really, really wanting to, really understanding why it's useful and important maybe for you to pay a little bit more attention to what's happening in the present moment, to your feelings, your thoughts, your reactions, and what's going on. And really feel that it has some connection to something very important for you. So to spend some time finding out for yourself what is most important in your life. What is your heartfelt, deepest intention for your life? What is the thing you most want for, you know, being alive? You know, we're only alive once, supposedly, or unless you're Buddhist, then you're alive many times. But anyway, this is the only life we know about for most of us. So this is very precious. And so what do we want to do with this life here? And how do we want to use our time well? There's often, at the end of life, many people will often review their life to some degree. And how do you want to review your life? Do you want to be known because you want to think back about how well you loved or how much money you made? You know, what is the important values that we hold in the normal life? So really, to spend some time exploring and thinking about then, what is the deepest values you want to live by? And then see if there's a connection between that and doing mindfulness practice, of being mindful. If you can find that connection, then you might find a little more fire or inspiration underneath your motivation to start paying more attention in daily life as you go along. And being inspired or motivated is a very important, very useful. Aside from that, there are many kind of aids or helps to try to be more mindful in the course of a day's activities. Many people will find that there are little cues that they use to pay attention. Some people use a telephone. If you're answering a telephone a lot, whenever the telephone rings, that's a cue to not answer the phone automatically, but let it ring three times. And while it's ringing three times, just connect to your breathing and feel your breathing a little bit, or just connect and notice what's happening with you. Are you frazzled? Are you rushing about? Are you upset? Just notice what's going on now in the present moment. Just take a few moments to wake up, to pay attention. And then answer the phone. So some people love that, you know, if they're on the phone a lot. Just if the person on the other line can wait three rings. So something that I used for a long time was doorways. Whenever I went through a door, I would pay attention. I would use that as a suggestion to pay attention now. And it made some sense, because if you're going into a new space, you want to kind of be there for it. You want to notice what's happening there, and so you don't unconscious as you enter a new area. So I use door frames, and I would find that, you know, I go through doors many times in the course of a day, and each time I went through, I would kind of, what's happening for me? What's my experience right now? As opposed to just continuing my kind of fantasy or train of thought or preoccupation that I was involved in. Some people will choose particular tasks, particular activities in a day that they focus on where they specialize in developing mindfulness in normal life. So for example, some people will eat breakfast, maybe in silence, and eat the breakfast. Don't read the paper, but really eat breakfast. See if you can be really mindful while eating breakfast and develop mindfulness there. Or one meal at lunch a week, you try to eat, you know, slowly, mindfully, really be attentive, discover what it's like to eat in an attentive way, rather than kind of eating automatically, which many of us do. Some people will choose, for example, driving to work. That's going to be their little meditation hall, meditation kind of building, their car. And so they drive, and while they're driving to work, they just kind of pay attention in the present moment, what's going on, their breath, their body, the cars, the other people, just whatever. Trying to wake up a little bit and try to stay in the present moment as a training. Some people will choose, you know, one week they'll choose light switches. And whenever they're going to turn on something, they say, okay, let me take just 2 or 3 seconds to pay attention to what's going on right now with myself and the world around me. And so you do that for a week, just light switches. And after a while it becomes a little bit kind of, you know, regular or habit maybe. And after you've got light switches down, that you're going to be in the present moment when you switch on a light. You get the light switches down, then you go to, you know, whenever you answer the phone. And after you get that down, then you go whenever you wash the dishes. And once you get that down, then you do whenever, you know, you go to the bathroom. And after, you know, a year or something of this, or 52 weeks of this, if you do one thing a week, much of your life begins to kind of become a little bit more familiar territory for beginning to wake up and pay attention. It's quite lovely. Valuing. You know, I talked about motivation, being motivated, but also valuing the importance, the usefulness of paying attention to normal life is sometimes, it's not so obvious that it's useful to pay attention, but learning to, that it's useful, and not to compare it against some other more spiritual thing that you think you might be able to do. It's very spiritual to pay attention to whatever's going on. I like this quote by Gary Snyder, where he says, "All of us are apprenticed to the same teacher that the religious institutions originally worked with, namely reality. Reality insight says, master the 24 hours. Do it well without self-pity. It is as hard to get the children herded into the carpool and down the road to the bus as it is to chant sutras, scriptures, in the Buddha hall on a cold morning. One move is not better than the other. Each can be quite boring, and they both have the virtuous quality of repetition. Repetition and ritual and their good results come in many forms. Changing the filter, wiping noses, going to meetings, picking up around the house, washing dishes, checking the dipstick. Don't let yourself think that these are distracting you from your more serious pursuits. Such a round of chores is not a set of difficulties we hope to escape from so that we may do our practice, which will put us on a path. It is our path." So one of the things that Buddhist spirituality tries to do is not to bifurcate our life between, and this is very difficult, Buddhists will constantly do this anyway, not to bifurcate our life between what is real spiritual life, what's a real spiritual thing to do, and that which it is not. What we're trying to do is to bring attention and awareness and wakefulness to all things equally, and not think that doing some particular activity is making you more spiritual. You know, if I wear, you know, I don't know what, you know, if I get the right kind of zafu, or if I sit every day for 45 minutes, or if I go to the right meditation group, or if I go, you know, some activity is the definition of being a good Buddhist. A good Buddhist is someone basically who's interested, inspired to try to bring attention to all of our life. Washing dishes, taking a shower, taking out the trash, being in conflict with someone. Being in conflict with someone is as good a meditation practice as anyone else, anything else. It's difficult, but we can learn to pay attention there also. So do you have any questions, any comments? Yes.
Can we allow daydreaming of life, provided that we are aware of it?
You can also allow it without being aware of it. There's a place for everything, you know, and it isn't like necessarily, I think it's a little bit oppressive to think that you have to be awake and attentive to the present moment for every possible moment in your life. There's a place for kind of daydreaming and drifting off, and but the idea is to know when that is, and to have some choice in the matter, and not to be swept up in daydreaming unknowingly. So, for example, for me, I think thinking is a great thing to do, to think about things, and I think it's very creative sometimes and useful. I don't think when I'm meditating, but sometimes I go for a walk where I'm living, or I go for a run. And it's, you know, then my mind kind of is set free and I start thinking, and I don't try to stop that kind of thinking or that kind of daydreaming that might happen. It has its place too. Yes?
You spoke earlier briefly about giving attention to whatever comes in the room, as we're in the easy chair, observing, being mindful. I had an experience in this last sitting of a very painful ankle, and you use the knee. As I tried twice to bring my attention to it and just
be with it for as long as I could stand it. And the interesting thing was, bringing attention to it didn't allow it to dissipate, it made it bigger. And suddenly my ankle was the size of an elephant, and I felt squashed into a corner and incredibly claustrophobic with this great pain that was just growing uncontrollably. If something gets, and actually then dissipating off into other thoughts and thinking about some of tomorrow's chores, then the discomfort dissipated. Is that denial? Is that fair?
Well, this is such a common technique or a strategy of many people, is to use distraction to avoid what's really going on for them. And that's some people really develop this into an art. So they're never really present, and they're always kind of using fantasy or thinking or distractions as a way of not really being honest about what's really going on. I don't think, there's no necessity to stay with a painful ankle. However, it can be very useful to use some discomfort in meditation as a place to train yourself to learn to have that ability to stay present and not to run away from it, and to discover, to find out what happens to me, what's my relationship to it that makes it really difficult and uneasy to be with it. It's possible to have tremendous burning, searing pain in the body, and the rest of you is quite at ease, is cool. And a lot of the heat of our reactions to pain has to do with our reactions, has to do with our self-pity or whatever. And sometimes when a particular pain gets really, really big in our experience, it's sometimes because we are afraid of it, or we are preoccupied with it in a kind of way. Oh my God, you know, and worried about it. Oh my God, I can't do it. Oh no. And one of the fascinating things is people will report sometimes that they're sitting with tremendous pain. Oh, it was the biggest pain I've ever had. It's worse. It was terrible. You know, I thought I was going to die. And, or they talk about impatience. You know, I had so much impatience. I was going to die. I couldn't stand it one more minute. Oh, you know, one more second. And oh, it was just the worst. But then the teacher rang the bell to end the sitting.
I was praying for the bell.
And as soon as the bell rang, I was still sitting there, and it all dissipated. And we realize how much of our, you know, the oomph, or the, how much of the intensity of some of our experiences has to do with the ways we get wrapped up in it, and not in the experience in and of itself. So being able to, so one of the reasons to hang out with difficulties is to start teasing apart the ways we're entangled with it. But if we too quickly go off and distract ourselves, I grant you it's more pleasant, but there's little insight, little understanding that can come from that. And you're not really developing the patience, developing the strength of ease that can come. So there'll be situations in your life where you don't have a choice. And if you haven't done the training, you haven't prepared yourself, then you know it'll be harder than if you've prepared yourself.
It's also possible you need to go to the doctor. If it's really
doctor. It's also fine to change your posture. One of the guidelines I use is if you're starting getting discouraged because of the physical discomfort, then by all means change your posture.
I read in, I think Thich Nhat Hanh described one way of being mindful is do what you're doing. And I found that very, that somehow made great sense to me.
Well, that's nice.
So you had breakfast, you were having breakfast.
Yeah.
Not thinking about work. And this way you can do it all the time. Whatever you do, you should be doing, and not. I mean, if you're daydreaming, you can make that choice.
I think that's nice. Just do what you're doing. It's kind of one of the related ideas is just do one thing at a time, and it's not necessary to do one thing at a time. I learned in the monastery to do many things at once, but it's a very good training. To really do one thing at a time is very helpful as a way of bringing the practice into everyday life. So do what you're doing is a nice idea. In bringing mindfulness in daily life, sometimes it's useful to think of synonyms for the word mindfulness. other words that kind of might be related for you, but kind of maybe capture more the sense that in a particular context. So, for example, one of the words I liked a lot was participation. So rather than asking how to be more mindful in the situation, the quest was, how can I participate more fully in the situation? And that way I wasn't so split from it. Sometimes mindfulness kind of lends itself to the idea you're supposed to always be the observer, kind of watching it. But sometimes just wholeheartedly participating, this is where you are, is really what's called for in this situation. So that's a nice synonym, participation sometimes. Another one word I like is acceptance. So rather than how can I be more mindful of this particular thing, how can I be more accepting of this particular thing? So you might play with that if it's interesting for you with different words. But it's nice, do what you're doing. In the back, I guess. Yes.
I'm struggling with some of the paradox of thinking and not thinking during the meditation, that on one hand, to catch yourself thinking and then move back to the breath, but on the other hand, make the thought the meditation itself, and so I'm confused about how long to stay with the thoughts and how deeply to go with the thoughts. Does it vary from thought type to thought type?
I think it varies with the intensity that we're involved in, the intensity of the thinking. If it's just kind of very light kind of surface chatter that, you know, just kind of floating through, that somehow we've gotten hooked onto and we get carried away in, then just come back to the breath. Don't worry about it. Just come back to the breath, come back to the breath. But if it has more oomph to it, so that it's a little bit more compelling, and so it's not difficult to come back to the breath easily, that's when you want to just have mindfulness of the event of thinking. And you can be mindful of it for a long time. It's very compelling. Sometimes there are very compelling things that, you know, take over our whole being, and we're kind of preoccupied with it totally. And it's very hard to let go of those thoughts. And rather than, getting upset, just accept that there's a certain momentum here because I'm really caught up. And let me just be aware of thinking. Let me acknowledge that I'm thinking and be present for that in a simple way. And it could be the whole meditation practice, thinking. What does it feel like to think? What does experience my body of this kind of preoccupation? What is the energetics? What are the emotions connected to it? It depends a little bit on the intensity. And if it's no longer compelling or if it seems to have passed away, then you can come back to the breath. Is that clear? Is it clear enough?
Is the idea there that though you're not supposed to get caught in the story, though, you're just focusing on the fact that you're thinking?
Yes. The idea is not to be caught in anything. But so if it's in your meditation practice, if you're just meditating, there's almost nothing you need to think about when you meditate. So then it's easy to just let go of it. Not easy, but you can let go of it, you know. But in normal life, you might want to decide whether this is important to think about. You don't have to give up. You don't give up all your thoughts because, you know, just, is this useful to think about? You know, you find yourself totally preoccupied about winning the California lottery, and you find yourself all day long kind of thinking about the California lottery, and, you know, how are you going to spend all the money if you win, and how are you going to help all your friends, and how this friend is not going to get that much from you, and this and more. You know, I don't know how useful it is to be thinking those kinds of thoughts. One of the very important things that I learned from starting to do Buddhist meditation practice was that I had some choice in what I was thinking about. It had never occurred to me before that. I just thought, you know, you have your thoughts, you know, and they just kind of, that's, you know, who I am. I don't know what I thought, but they just, you know, thoughts are just, you know, they're given, you know, whatever you're thinking about. But I learned through meditation practice that there's a lot of choice in what you think about. And I can see what I'm thinking about now. And if I'm thinking about the California lottery and how I'm going to spend all this money, if I see that, you're pretty certain that pretty quickly that I'm going to say, wait a minute. I have better things to think about if I'm going to be thinking about something at all. Let me think about, you know, whatever. So you can switch your thoughts sometimes in a very kind of simple way, or let go of them.
What I have trouble with, if you sort of talked about some people being like this, is that I'm a compulsive planner. I'm always sitting there planning and thinking, I should write this down, I should not forget this, and then I think I should return to the breath. And the plan for me, I'm sort of going, go away,
go away. I don't want to be doing this. I could be doing this at some other time. This isn't the time to be doing it. And I sort of don't know how to do that separation, how to not get caught in it.
I think for you, maybe the useful thing is to drop down into the feelings associated with all these things. Because just as you were speaking about it, there was almost like a different feeling tone in the different things. In the planning, there was, I don't know if I was right, but a little bit more anxiety.
Yeah.
As soon as you said come back to the breath, there was kind of a calmness. And then the next day, it was kind of like pushing away. It was like, I don't know, there was a different kind of feeling tone to it. If you pay attention to the feeling tone, it's often a way of dropping down to a deeper level. And it's a lot easier to not be so caught up.
Yeah, it's clear. I mean, it's very clear that the planning is both creates anxiety, but I think it's also a way to alleviate it. It's sort of like a
yes.
Trying to get in control of it.
I can well imagine. Yes.
I have experienced this morning that I have a lot of fearful thoughts, and having listened to last week's lecture about sort of moving through things, these fearful thoughts just came, and instead of hanging on to them, I would let them go, and then another one would come, and I would let it go, another one. And then one of the fearful thoughts came back again, and I had a funny reaction. My question is really, is this a common experience? What I said, oh, I've thought about that one before. I don't think I need to do that. And then I moved on to another one. And it was like I had moved through these scary thoughts. And the thoughts prior to doing this was, oh, I shouldn't have this thought. And so then they would always come back. And so I'm wondering, is that a common experience of
the thoughts reoccur?
Reoccurring, but then it was like, oh, I'm resisting the thought where it used to always reoccur, and it was like, oh, I've been through this. I don't need to think this again. And then it sort of passed.
Yeah, I can well imagine that's, you know, you can do that. That seems completely normal. Yes.
Sleepiness.
Ah, sleepiness. Sleepiness is a frequent visitor to people who meditate a lot. And there's the pure answer and the pragmatic answer. The pure answer is that mindfulness practice is learning how to be mindful of whatever's occurring. And almost synonymous with mindfulness, not quite, is acceptance. Is not reacting to it, allowing it to be there, simply bringing attention to that. And not being concerned about what it is and measuring it against any kind of idea of what a good meditation is. Just this being honest about your own experience in the present moment. If your own experience is sleepiness, that's what you're supposed to pay attention to. Pay attention to sleepiness. You know, become the world-class expert on what it's like to be sleepy. You feel the heaviness, you feel the heaviness in the eyes and the kind of, you know, the sandpaper feeling and the temperature maybe in the cheeks and the kind of heaviness in the shoulders and you know, the puffiness in the eyes. There's all kinds of wonderful sensations to be had, and then you're not so aware so often because you kind of doze off, and then you wake up and you realize you doze off, and then you find yourself notice that you're being reactive. You're judging. Oh my God, I'm a terrible meditator. I lost it, and I'm sleeping. Oh, terrible. Oh, judging. I'm judging. No, isn't that interesting? Here's a human being who's judging. Disappointment. Oh, okay. That's interesting, disappointed. Oh, they've passed away. Okay, it's passed. I'm no longer judging, no longer disappointed. That's nice. What's happening now? I'm sleepy. Okay. Okay, so what is sleepiness like? Well, I feel all this, you know, weight and pulling down. And you're exploring it. And as you explore it, you kind of feel this energy, and the energy kind of wakes you up, maybe. Maybe not. Or maybe, you know, again, you fall asleep. And the point is just to kind of matter of fact, like kind of pay attention to what's actually going on now. And sleepiness is just part of what passes through, and it's hard to pay attention when you're sleepy, and just you're aware that it's hard, and you don't make a big deal of it. Just your job is to bring the best mindfulness you can to a situation, without any measurement about measuring that against some standard, what that is. Your best mindfulness will vary depending on different situations. If you're really sleepy, your best mindfulness is not going to be as sharp and as alert as it, when it is when you, after you've had five cups of coffee. The pure answer is just bring the best mindfulness to that event. Don't worry about it. Just bring your best mindfulness to it.
And don't fight it if you actually feel yourself.
You don't fight it. Don't fight it. Just keep bringing your best mindfulness. You know, there's no reason. No need to resist anything in this practice. Just your job is to try to bring mindfulness to everything. And then eventually you'll wake up. Maybe you need to sleep. That's part of it. Another part of the kind of more pure answer is there's many different areas you can explore in sleepiness. So one is just the physicality of it. Sometimes sleepiness occurs for other reasons besides being sleepy. Sometimes it occurs because it's a form of escape. We're uncomfortable with what's going on. And we have this, human beings have this ability. When you see it now, I'm learning now how because I have this new baby, I'm learning how much of what I see in adults, it seems to be programmed into us as kids, as children, and we're just kind of continuing the same behavior. He falls asleep if it gets too noisy around him. And I think it's a protective mechanism. When there's too much chaos, you just fall asleep. Well, as adults, if it gets too emotionally difficult situations, or the memories, or the feelings, or they get too difficult in meditation, some people will fall asleep because they can't handle it. In that case, then, bringing very careful attention to the feelings and the emotions just prior to falling asleep can be a key to understand what's going on. Sometimes sleepiness in meditation occurs because a person is too concentrated or too calm. And you can actually get too calm with not enough energy in the practice. And simply to recognize, oh, there's lots much energy here, I'm too calm. Sometimes just the recognition can kind of wake things up a little bit. So the pure answer is just we pay attention the best we can to the situation. The pragmatic answer, which is not the purest answer, is you can do things to help yourself wake up. The pure answer is you don't try to do anything besides just pay attention, just allow things to be and take their own course. But you know, it's a little bit foolish to be too much of a purist. So you can sit up straighter. Sometimes sitting up straight can bring more energy. You can open your eyes. Sometimes, sitting facing a light source, either with your eyes closed or eyes open, can bring more alertness and aliveness, and you can be more awake. Washing your face with cold water sometimes can wake you up. Sometimes contemplating death is a classic reflective meditation people use when they're sleepy, and it wakes them up. You mean I'm going to die too? Suddenly they're awake. Jack Kornfield tells a story of, I think it was Jack, that he was really sleepy in his monastery in Thailand, and his teacher had him meditate on the edge of a well. Because when you fall asleep, you can kind of fall, you go like this, right? Start falling over. And so that kept him awake. I knew one person who put, I think he was sitting in a meditation hall with other people, and he put like a little cup or beanbag or something on top of his head full of marbles. And so that if he fell asleep, all these marbles would fall on the floor and make a mess and make all the noise and wake everybody else up. And so that kept him motivated. I think those techniques are a bit extreme. But there are, you know, simple things you can do. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So.
It's just that the metaphor is always to wake up.
No, you're falling asleep. You do the best you can. If you're aware that you're falling asleep, you're succeeded.
You're awake about falling asleep.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you just accept what you're at, where you're at. Sometimes doing walking meditation is useful. You can switch. I haven't talked about walking meditation, but I think I will in a few weeks. One thing to do instead of, if you're really sleepy, rather than doing sitting meditation, is to get up and do walking meditation. And it's one of the ways of meditating in our tradition that's accepted as valid, as useful as sitting practice. And because you're walking back and forth, it brings more energy and more alertness, and it's more difficult to fall asleep. So sometimes if I'm really sleepy in the early morning or late at night, I'll walk rather than sit because of, you know, I want to do the practice. So I'll talk about that in a few weeks. This is the last day of this introductory course, and what happens next Thursday is we keep meeting at 7 o'clock from 8:30, but the schedule reverts to our usual one, which is we come at 7 and sit for half an hour, and then from 7:30 to about 8:15 we have a talk and some discussion about things, and then we end with 15 minutes of sitting at the end. And at the end of a five-week introductory course, I just imagine that we're just continuing the course, as if it was a 6- and 7-, 8-week course. Meaning that I kind of talk about topics that seem very relevant, kind of following up on this five-week course. So if you're interested in learning more that seem relevant, kind of continuing kind of what we're talking about so far, you can come back and we'll just continue for a while. And one of the things I'll talk about, I think, in a few weeks is walking meditation. That's plenty for today. Let's just sit for a minute, just a last little taste. I would like to read this one quote that I read partly kind of as maybe a warning to not to be too pure about meditation practice or Buddhist practice. The point of Buddhist practice is to discover yourself, is to be yourself fully, and not to impose some other idea of self on top of yourself. This was written by a monk, priest who visited Mount Athos, monastic center in Greece. And when he was visiting Mount Athos, he wrote this about the monk that he met there. The monk was in a very bad state, very dark, very bitter, very angry. When asked what was the matter, he said, "Look at me. I've been here for 38 years and have not yet attained pure prayer. And this other fellow on the pilgrimage with me was saying how sad he thought this was." Another man present said, "It's a sad story, all right, but the sadness consists in the fact that after 38 years in a monastery, he's still interested in pure prayer." It isn't pure meditation we want, it's pure you. To discover who you are, to really be yourself. And really, the mindfulness practice is not a technique to kind of add on top of your life. It's really the idea, the spirit behind it. I haven't been very good in conveying it, I feel, but the spirit is not a technique, but rather is a opening to allow your life to flow more freely through you. So you discover more fully what your life is, and so you can be more fully yourself. The opening is the opening into awareness itself. A few announcements that I'd like to make. One is there's a really wonderful Buddhist monk in our tradition who's going to be teaching here in Palo Alto on Saturday. He's doing a one-day retreat. And if you want to get a taste of a one-day retreat, this is a great one to do your first one, because he likes to talk a lot. And he's very wise and very eloquent, and all this wisdom pours out of him. And it's really great to be with him. So we tend not to do as much sitting as some of the other kind of one-day retreats. And so it's a little bit more gentle for people who haven't done a lot of meditation. And you can just come for part of the day, just show up. It's somewhat casual. But it's also very special. It's really really precious. This is a really someone I respect a lot, and it's really nice that he's going to be coming to our community. And it's Saturday from 9 to 4:30, and it's at St. Mark's, which is the the Episcopal Church, 600 Colorado. It's on Colorado, same street as this, just one block west of Middlefield, and it's in the parish hall. It's not in the church proper, but in the big hall. It's in the back of the property. 9 to 4:30, and potluck is on the 21st. It's a hardwood floor, so if you're going to sit, you're going to sit on the floor. You need to bring something to sit on, some mat or cushion. Oh, and Buddhist monks will only eat what people bring them that particular day. So he's not going to eat unless we feed him. And so some people will bring a little bit extra food and make an offering to him. Which is kind of a nice thing to do. Lunch is early because he has to finish eating before 12 o'clock. And he can't eat after 12 o'clock. They have all these rules, the monks. And so so we should probably stop around 11 o'clock for lunch and feed him and feed ourselves. And then, a little bit early lunch that day. Oh. The monk. His name is Amaro. And Ajahn means like teacher, Ajahn Amaro. And sometimes we have, I don't know if we have it out there now, sometimes we have out in the hall, we have this literature table, all kinds of literature, but sometimes we have out there a register if you want to sign your name and give us your address. Is out there? You can, some of you might want to get me on our mailing list. And or just be in our directory. So you can kind of put your name and address there if you'd like to kind of be included in things we do. Do we have these letters out there? We have these envelopes out there, these letters. They're on the Donna basket there. We have the grand plans of getting our own center someday. Because we do so many things, it'd be very useful to have our own center to be able to offer kind of a full range of meditation practices to our community here. But for that, we need to do some fundraising. So if you're either interested in learning about our vision and what we want to do, want to make a donation, you can pick up one of these and see what it's about. So I thank you, and I thank you for your participation here this course, and I wish you all well, and I hope that mindfulness practice is something that is useful for you, and you'll find some way that helps helps you become a more awake and more compassionate, more loving person in your life. Thank you.